So our topic for today is the myths of testosterone, and we have three fabulous speakers lined up for you today, the second of which you do not expect, but it's fabulous nonetheless, and I will tell you more about that later. I wanted to express my gratitude to the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences for co-sponsoring our event today, especially to Professor Deborah Bell and Catherine Caldwell-Harris, who I think is not able to make it yet today, but they've been wonderful colleagues and co-conspirators in putting together our event today. So our first speaker today is Sari Van Anders, who comes to us from University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. She's a professor of psychology and a professor of women's studies there. She is a leading expert in social neuroendocrinology and has done research, especially in connection with gender, sexuality, and sexual diversity. So she'll be speaking to us, well, she doesn't have her slide up yet, but that will just take a minute. I assume your title hasn't changed, but she'll be speaking to us on the topic of testosterone, gender, sex, and sexuality, empirical findings from social neuroendocrinology. Please join me in welcoming Professor Van Anders.
Okay, can you all hear me okay? Yes? Okay. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a delight to be here, especially with the folks we'll be speaking with. So one of the first things I want to talk to you about is just briefly some information about testosterone that might be useful. It's a steroid hormone. It's one of many androgens. It's structurally similar to estradiol and other estrogens, and in fact, testosterone can be converted to estradiol through a process called aromatization. It influences the likelihood of cellular activity. It doesn't cause behavior. It's released from the gonads, the testes, and the ovaries, as well as the adrenal glands, and through peripheral conversion in fatty tissue or adipose tissue. It's present in women and men, and on average, it's higher in men than in women, and I'm gonna come back to that point. And I promise you, I think that's our most boring slide so far. But definitely so far, hopefully throughout. Now, I want to shift into talking about testosterone and its relation to binaries. And perhaps because testosterone is higher on average in men than in women, we tend to think of testosterone as the male hormone. That's not just a media spin on testosterone. If you look at hormone textbooks, for example, testosterone will be actually named the male hormone. Now, we can think of that, obviously, in relation to a gender binary. So testosterone accounting for maleness, maleness being contrasted with femaleness. But there's actually not one, just one binary or one gender binary. There's many binaries we might think of as falling under that broader rubric of gender binary. One of them has to do with male-female, another has to do with feminine-masculine, and another that I'm particularly interested in has to do with sex versus gender. So there's all these different binaries. Now I want to talk a little bit more about those and sort of organize them. We can think about the ways that sex, gender as a binary is actually kind of the organizing principle for a male-female binary and a masculine-feminine binary. And by that I mean, let's see, does this work? Can you all see this one if I use this one? I actually can't point on both at the same time. It's a little known fact. What we can see is that sex can be divided into maleness and femaleness. Gender can be divided into masculinity and femininity. And so this sort of superordinate binary has subordinate binaries that are built into it already. Now, if we focus in on that sex-gender binary, like I said, we can think of sex as relating to female-male binary, but we can also add in sex diversity into there to sort of bust that binary. We can think of gender as being masculinity and femininity, and we can add gender diversity in there to bust that binary. And what we mean by sex and gender is that sex we usually use to mean factors about femaleness, maleness, and sex diversity that are biological, evolved, physiological. And by gender, we mean factors about masculinity, femininity, and gender diversity that are sociocultural in some way. So that's how I'm using these terms. Now, where would testosterone go? It's not a trick question. I think it's obvious to most of us where we would put testosterone, and that is in sex. And that makes a lot of sense because testosterone is shaped by selection. It responds to evolutionarily salient behaviors. It doesn't just respond to anything. It has an evolved social function across species. Even though there's also species specificities in the way that evolved social function plays out, and that includes human specificities that I'll be focusing on a lot in this talk. And testosterone has what we in feminist science studies or other science studies areas might call material agency, meaning it actually isn't sort of just a social construction, it doesn't just do anything we want it to, it has particular constraints that we don't set. So to recap, right now we're at the place where testosterone is basically the biological essence or a bioessence of maleness and of sex. So you might be able to see where I'm going with this, which is the question, is testosterone the bioessence of maleness and sex? And to first address that question, I want to give you just two really brief snippets of empirical evidence from work we've done in our lab, and then I'm going to come back and talk a lot more about research in a little bit as well. One of them is that we've done some research showing that sexual thoughts increase testosterone. This is work in women. And what this is showing is that we had people come into our lab and we randomly assigned them to one of four imagined social situation exercise scenarios. One of them was to think sexual thoughts. I'm also a sex researcher and not just a social neuroendocrinologist. I feel like there's a joke in there about that, but I don't know what it is, unfortunately. Fortunately for all of us. We also had a neutral condition where it was just basically passage of time. We also had a stressful condition because there might be something stressful for some people about having to come into a lab and think sexual thoughts. And we also had a positive condition because we want to make sure if we see effects of sexual thoughts that they're just not due to the potentially positive effects of coming into a lab and thinking sexual thoughts, especially which you might think might happen for people who volunteer for a study that involves coming into a lab and thinking sexual thoughts. And what we found is that the sexual thoughts increase testosterone relative to baseline and compared to some of the conditions. And that was interesting to us, that sexual thoughts are increasing testosterone in women. Now that's kind of interesting also for another reason, because as I said before, testosterone exists in women and men, but we call it the male hormone. So we could even ask, what's testosterone doing in women if it's a male hormone anyway, right? So we'll just bracket that for now. Another study we did is looking at the effects of nurturance on testosterone. This one is in men. And what we found is that nurturant interactions with this baby simulator actually decrease testosterone. Now what we did is we had people come in and we randomly assigned them to one of four conditions, again, a neutral control, just hearing the audio-taped baby cries, and then with a baby simulator that is probably just as cheesy as you might imagine, and many of you, some of you might have had the good fortune of having to experience it during sex ed. The goal of it was to try to scare you into not having kids, so not having sex so that you wouldn't have the kids so you wouldn't have to deal with the crying. Although apparently at some point in your adult life you're supposed to be okay with dealing with crying babies and all that's supposed to wash out. But we used it for this. And what happens is it has a little bracelet thing, a little sensor, and when the baby's crying, you have to swipe it, and then you have to do one of various things you might do with a baby to calm it down, like rock it, feed it, change its diaper, pat its back, burp it, various things. The false baby interaction was we didn't give them the bracelet, so nothing they did could work, which is maybe the only study I've ever done with deception, and probably the one I feel worst about, being a parent of young babies myself. And what you can see here is that hearing baby cries significantly increased testosterone if you couldn't nurturantly engage with them. Being able to nurturantly and effectively engage with the babies decreased testosterone. Now the points of these two studies I've given you, I think they're interesting in their own right and they're going to come up again later, but is that testosterone is socially modulated, right? So I've shown you two pieces of evidence that testosterone responds to social situations and changes in response to them. So is testosterone sex? Biological, evolved, and physiological, which I've sort of already argued that it is, or is it gender? Because it responds to social situations. Social situations change testosterone. It's not a static, innate, fixed, inborn biochemical property flowing through our bodies. It also responds to our social situations. That's probably somewhat unsatisfying as well, though. So instead, we might want to think, is testosterone actually something else entirely? And the language I use to talk about testosterone is gender sex, as something that is both social and evolved. So gender sex is a way for us to get beyond gender binary and think about phenomena that are both exist in evolutionary context and social context. And it's a way to think about not masculinity, femininity, not femaleness, maleness, but whole people, women and men and gender diverse people. Now, why do I use gender sex? One of the reasons is that, as I said, some phenomena are neither gender nor sex. Right, when we walk through the world, we walk through the world as individuals in biological bodies that have evolved, but also been subject to however long our lifetime is of socialization. So that's true of us as whole people, and that's also true of the various biological parameters in our bodies. Now, I use gender first before sex for a bunch of reasons. One is, some of you might know this research that shows whatever comes first in a pair is usually the one that is in the power-up position or part of a dominant paradigm, so that's why people say men and women, male, female, masculine, feminine.
And I think it's important to disrupt that, but also because gender is always going to be a primary lens that we have to see things through, even if we're looking at sex. Even if we want to talk about sex without gender, we're always seeing it through a lens of gender, because we're human beings. So gender sex is a way to do something I call social neuroendocrinology, which is a way to look at hormone behavior interactions in humans that attends to both evolutionary and social context. And it's a way for us to sidestep nature-nurture debates and be able to think about them as interactive properties, which I think people pay a lot of lip service to, but there's actually a few research paradigms that look at them in interaction. Now, what do I mean exactly by social context? I could mean a variety of things. Some of them might include things like social groups. We know that there are ways that people are grouped according to their gender sex, their socialization, the ways we experience gender norms, the way we internalize those, the ways we're punished or rewarded for engaging in gender-typical or atypical behaviors, and also social constructions. Now, social constructions is a term, for those of you who are scientists, that is often thrown at scientists as if it's the opposite of biology. And so my experience is that many people are resistant to what social constructions are because they've been used sometimes by people in a way that gets perceived as undermining their scientific enterprise. I don't think that's actually how people use it, but that's often how it's heard. And sometimes that's how it's used. So I think that sometimes social constructions are somewhat misunderstood, and so I want to talk just briefly about them. I would say they're shared and ingrained social understandings of phenomena. They vary over time and place, but that variability is sometimes mistaken for malleability. Social constructions are actually often not malleable. They're not easily changed. And some examples of that are things like poverty or racism, which vary over time and place. They change, but they're not easily changeable. In fact, they're probably less easily changeable than our neurotransmitters are. They're not imaginary or unreal, which is another way people characterize social constructions. For example, you can think of things like money or nation borders, which are certainly social constructions, but very real with very real material consequences and implications. And as I'm going to be arguing, they're not enemies of biological research. And what I'm hoping to convince you throughout this talk is that taking biology and social constructions into account in the same research program makes for transformative science. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about socially constructing testosterone and two ways we might think about that are relevant for the science we might want to do and for the science I do in my own lab. And the first one is via cultural narratives, which is the more traditional and I think better known way of understanding social constructions. So testosterone is certainly a biochemical substance that circulates in our bodies, but it's also clearly a cultural narrative circulating in our cultures. And I did a Google image search, and you don't have to really scroll down at all to get some interesting images. So you can probably see images of men who don't look like almost any men we might ever see. You might see the sorts of things you're supposed to be able to get. Let's see. If you use testosterone, objects you might get, like women. And you can also see that there's some concern about boosting testosterone, how vital it is to boost it. Modern men lack testosterone. Very few of the things that are going to come up that you're going to see have to do with decreasing testosterone. So our culture certainly has ideas about what is good or bad about testosterone in terms of high or low, what it's supposed to do, and who it's supposed to do it in. So we have cultural narratives about testosterone, and all scientists, just like all people, unless they were raised by wolves, so if you know of anyone, let me know, have been raised within cultures that have ideas about testosterone. And that's true of many phenomena that scientists study. That's not true of all scientific phenomena, right? There's all sorts of scientific phenomena people actually don't have cultural understandings of, they've never heard of, they don't circulate in the media in any way. You couldn't, if you did a Google image search of them, only scientific articles would come up. That's clearly not the case for testosterone. Now, testosterone has these cultural narratives, and one of the things those cultural narratives can do is shape, distort, and blinker the sorts of science we might produce. Because we already have, even as scientists, ideas about what testosterone means, that actually can affect the sorts of questions we do. So for example, I've actually done some research on cuddling and testosterone. I'm not going to tell you about it. I don't know why. But I should. Now I'm just telling you I'm not telling you about it. But cuddling is not the sort of thing we would typically look at with testosterone because of the cultural narratives that shape it. So it's sort of like culture acts as these blinkers. We think, well, these questions we'll ask, but not those questions, because that's not what we think is meaningful. And that shapes the sort of science that gets produced, and therefore shapes what we know about testosterone as a biomaterial substance, as a biochemical as a hormone that's circulating in our bodies. And we might call that a sort of pre-theory route of social construction. And by pre-theory, I mean the ideas that shape our science before we even do theoretically informed work. Right? Before we do our studies, before we have formal theory we've laid out, how do we even know where we want to start or what kind of questions we want to ask? And we might say pre-theory is what does that. And that's a term I've learned from feminist science studies, and especially Elizabeth Lloyd. Now, what might that look like? What I'm arguing is that pre-theory drives behavioral research on testosterone. So because we think we know testosterone is tied to masculinity or maleness, we tend to study it only in these four domains: aggression, mating, sexuality, and challenge. We think masculinity is sort of the thematic structure that holds all those together. And we would study the inverse of masculinity as being femininity in that inversion model, and we think of testosterone as being negatively related to parenting through femininity. Now, the actual research in humans and many species is quite variable and doesn't actually hold together in this way. Aggression in humans is basically unlinked to testosterone. And people are always kind of like, are you sure? I don't know. You say you're a testosterone researcher, but now I'm not sure because you said that. But it's true, and I've actually read the papers. Mating, depending on how you define mating, can be associated with low or high testosterone. For example, there's research showing that people in long-term relationships have lower testosterone. People who are single have higher testosterone, but depending on the relationship and or their approach to relationships, they can have higher or lower. Sexuality can be linked to lower or higher testosterone, which I'm going to tell you about a little bit later from research from our lab. Challenge is one that seems pretty uniformly linked to high testosterone, but even there, not always, and sometimes we think losses might decrease testosterone, which are still a part of challenges. Parenting also, interestingly, even though it's assumed, and in our theories, there's a hormone theory called the challenge hypothesis that is explicitly about how parenting is related to low testosterone, various aspects of parenting can actually be linked to high testosterone. As I showed you, hearing a baby cry is certainly seen as a parenting stimulus, but actually increased testosterone. So the actual empirical evidence is all over the place, but that doesn't fit our story. So it ends up falling into what we might call, or what Joan Fujimura calls, who's a feminist sociologist of science, an awkward surplus of knowledge. So we might say, well, yeah, that study is true, but we're not going to let it change any of our theory, and we might do that with all our studies. Put it over there, maybe like the awkward guest at a cocktail party. Everyone knows they're there, but you just don't have to talk to them, or something like that. I'm sure you're all nicer. I'm nice at cocktail parties, too. So masculinity narratives end up distorting scientific research, and one of the things I've argued is for a model that is part of a larger model called the steroid peptide theory of social bonds, but we're just focusing on testosterone, that basically, instead of thinking of masculinity as the holder or femininity as the holder for these high-low testosterone-associated social behavioral contexts, that we could think of nurturance, and we should think of nurturance as being linked to low testosterone or decreasing testosterone, and competition as increasing it. And I want to talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. So we think of testosterone as being linked to the social goal of a behavioral context. And this is a way, this SP theory is a way for us to think of testosterone in evolved and social context beyond this masculinity narrative. So what we would argue is that competition increases testosterone. And by competition, I mean acquiring or keeping resources in a really broad, almost cheesy evolutionary way. Those resources can be defined as territory, status, really anything that can be competed or defended or kept. And here are some examples of what that might look like. We think of nurturance as decreasing testosterone, and nurturance would be loving, supportive, warm contact between any individuals. And again, it might play out in these various ways. And I'm going to come back to this as well. Now, you might be thinking, oh, that looks a lot like it overlaps with gender. But one of the things I want to make clear is the SP theory isn't a gendered theory. So it's not that we think this explains masculinity in men or femininity in women. And in fact, you can look at this in women or men or gender diverse people. You can look at their testosterone responses to various social contexts. It's not about explaining sex differences. And in fact, it doesn't, because testosterone exists in women and men and responds to the same stimuli in women and men in general, with some gender specificities. And that makes sense because we're not in a post-gender world and we can't have post-gender theories either. If you think of these, one of the reasons we think of them as potentially overlapping with gender is because we have all sorts of gender norms that overlap with these constructs. So it's not as if women and men come to these or come to any one instance of competition or nurturance in a sort of naive or neutral way. They have a lifetime history of gender socialization that has either encouraged them to do one and punished them for the other, or vice versa. So they have a lifetime history of experiencing gender norms around these. So we've talked about this pre-theory way of socially constructing testosterone, which falls more in line with the cultural narratives way we tend to think of social constructions. But there's another way I want to talk about socially constructing testosterone as well, and that's through gender socialization. And we can think of gender socialization as shaping and constraining the behaviors men and women and gender diverse people can engage in, and that actually ends up indirectly affecting testosterone. So we might call that the biomateriality route. And what I mean by that is that our gender socialization is not just shaping what we know about testosterone or what we think is worth studying, but it's actually shaping the testosterone in our bodies by limiting or constraining the actual behaviors that we're engaging in, right? So when you think about nurturance, that's something we encourage girls and women to do and discourage and punish boys and men for doing in general, although of course that there's variation in that over time and place, because that is a social construction as well. And I want to talk about what that might look like. So if we were thinking about socially constructing testosterone via gender socialization, meaning socially constructing the actual hormone that circulates in our bodies, not just the story of it, we might think of it as sort of the social construction of gender affecting this hormone behavior association, so affecting gender sex. So one of the things I've done is look at this possible gender to testosterone pathway to understand what that might look like. And we tend to think that, we know that men on average have higher testosterone than women, and I would say almost uniformly we think of that as a sex difference. So I think whether you're a hormone scientist, whether you're a feminist scholar, we have generally tended to assume that men have higher testosterone than women do for reasons of sex, innate, fixed, evolved differences. But one of the things I'm arguing is not that the only reason men have higher testosterone than women is for socialization or social construction reasons, but that there might actually be some influence of gender on that sex difference or on our testosterone levels, the actual testosterone levels that are circulating in our bodies. What we did is an experimental manipulation where we brought in trained actors into our labs. We also had a professional theater director who worked with them to perform a monologue in stereotypically feminine or masculine ways. And what they did is fire someone. That was their monologue. And we used that as this example of competition, which includes this example of holding power. And we used firing someone and a monologue because then we didn't have to deal with the interactions with other people. And also because no matter whether you do it in a stereotypically feminine way, which is not seen as a powerful way to act in our culture, or a stereotypically masculine way, when you're firing someone, you're objectively holding the power in that situation. Or it seemed as close to objectively holding the power in a situation that we could conceptualize, we could conceive of. So people came in, they did a direction session, and then they came in, let's say, 3 weeks in a row, one for a neutral condition, one for a stereotypically masculine performance, and one for a stereotypically feminine performance. And this was a repeated measures within participant studies. So people did all these conditions. So what they did is they took a saliva sample, then they did one of their activities 1 week, they were counterbalanced. Then they did a time filler, because we tend to think that hormone changes show up in saliva 10 to 20 minutes after the activity, and then they took a post-activity saliva sample. And what we're interested in is whether it's the behaviors themselves holding power that changes testosterone, which we think, if you remember from the SP theory, we think that testosterone has an evolved social function. One of them has to do with responding to things like holding power or competition, or whether it's responding to the ways we perform behavior, which are going to differ over time and place, right? Masculinity and femininity, which testosterone shouldn't actually necessarily be responding to, because it can't have evolved to respond to the varying social constructions over time and place, except when they overlap with androgenically active behaviors, if that makes sense. Now, what we found is that it supported the what. It's really when you hold power that is changing testosterone and not the how you do it. So that supports our idea that it's not the stereotypical construction of masculinity necessarily, or its inverse femininity, but instead the what you're doing, that holding power no matter how you do it seems to increase testosterone in women specifically, and with no significant effect in men. And one of the things we think is that this happened in women and not men, for a whole host of reasons that might have to do with sort of physiological reasons having to do with basements and ceilings. We found it easier to increase testosterone in women and decrease it in men. perhaps because on average women have lower, so there's more room to go up, if that makes sense. But there's also the possibility that each acute act of competition is kind of a less salient signal against a backdrop of more frequent engagements in competition for men who have been socialized to engage in them more commonly. Sort of like an example you might think of as a candle in a dark room is brighter than a candle in an already lit room. So we could think of these not necessarily just as sex differences in testosterone, that men have higher T than women for reasons of sex, but also potentially gender, and that's where that gender sex makes sense to think about, that there's contributions of both. Now I want to talk more broadly about doing social neuroendocrinology and talk to you about some of the research we do on sexual desire in the lab to sort of show you what this might look like. So how are testosterone and sexual desire linked is this question I've been asking for over a decade, and is something we are doing a lot of research about ongoing. And in social neuroendocrinology, we might think about asking a few different questions to do that research. First of all, what is our pre-theory about testosterone? What is our theory about testosterone? We might think the same thing about desire. What's our pre-theory about desire and our formal theory about desire? What methods can we use to do this, right? Just because we're scientists doesn't mean we can only use certain methods. And how do we put this all together? Now, first of all, I've already told you about the pre-theory versus the formal theory of testosterone, and I think it's really important to disentangle those and make sure we know which are driving our actual research. Our pre-theory about sexual desire is quite interesting as well, and I haven't spelled that out. I would say when people are talking about desire, they often assume that what is meant is that it's desire to experience orgasm or genital pleasure. It's often about with another person, so people don't often just talk generically about desire as if it's desire for masturbation. They think it reflects an inner drive, so people often think of desire that is something that comes out of you. It's not something that comes out of an interaction. It's not something that responds to things. And we also tend to think of sexual desire as unitary, meaning maybe this half of the room has lower desire, that half of the room has higher desire, but everyone is high or low on the same phenomenon. It differs by degree, but not kind. Now, one of the things we've been really interested in is the way that partnered desire and solitary desire are actually quite different. Partnered desire, the desire to be sexual with another person, versus solitary desire, the desire to be sexual by oneself, so for example, to masturbate. And one of the things that's interesting to note is they're actually quite weakly correlated at a 0.3 level, which is really unexpected if they're representing the same thing. If desire is one unitary phenomenon, a 0.3 level between two of its subfactors would not really support that. More interestingly, I think, is that they're actually correlated in opposite ways with testosterone, which I think strongly suggests they're very different phenomena. So for example, here we're showing women with no solitary desire have significantly lower testosterone than women with some solitary desire. And over here is actually a negative correlation between dyadic desire and testosterone. And you might be kind of confused, but this is the pattern you would normally expect. This is the opposite pattern. So if you're thinking, is that the opposite pattern? Yes, that is the opposite pattern to what we would typically expect. And I'll be coming back to that. We also, let me come down here, think that partner desire is unitary, but actually there's all sorts of different facets to it when we look at it and try to check that out. So we asked women and men a bunch of different questions about last time you experienced desire, how strong was it too? And then we had a whole bunch of items that they could score on. What we did then is a factor analysis, which is kind of like a quantitative thematic analysis to draw out the factor structure. And what we found is that there's a lot of similarities by gender and sexual identity in the people we studied. The people we studied weren't that different other than by gender and sexual identity, so maybe it's not surprising. But you can see there's a lot of the same themes, and not all of them are eroticism, right? So eroticism ended up being a theme about, for example, desire to experience orgasm, which is the way we would typically think about sexual desire. But as you can see pretty clearly, there's a whole bunch of other factors. Now, we are not arguing that these are the factors of desire. And in fact, our point is that what desire is in part socially constructed and is going to vary by your sample, by the culture of the people you're studying. So you can see there's intimacy, things like stress relief, things like wanting to please a partner, but not in a like good way, more like you have to put them ahead of you. Sexual self-esteem, experiencing fantasy, power and control. What's also interesting is sexual desire is multifaceted, but the way it was multifaceted was itself socially situated. So as you can see, there are some differences by sexual identity. I've shown queer women and heterosexual women. And in our sample, queer women actually separated out thrill-seeking and eroticism, whereas for heterosexual women, that was one factor. And there was another factor that showed up for queer women, which had to do with relationship management. So we're not saying that everyone experiences desire in the same way. In fact, we're saying that's not the case, but we're also not saying everyone experiences it differently. Now, that's not surprising, thinking about differences by sexual identity for women, because of heteronormativity, the idea that we have expectations that women should be sexually interested in men, that women should be sexually passive, and men should be sexually agentic. So how does that play out? We did some qualitative work, interviews with women about sexual pleasure, orgasm, and desire. And here's some interesting quotes about sort of illuminating really well how sexual desire has social context. This is a quote from a heterosexual woman that we chose to reflect a theme. We're not cherry picking these quotes. These quotes actually reflect the themes that emerge through our thematic analyses. And we call this hetero desire because this really is about low erotic expectations for heterosexual women. And this, not all heterosexual women, but some, say that, and they're talking about orgasm, is just not an expectation at all for me during sex with their male partners. Versus a queer, what I call a queer yeah response. So this is a quote that's representative from a lesbian participant. And she says, I really do like to orgasm though, and that's not a big part of sex, and that's a big part of sex for me. Like, if I am, yeah, I haven't had any consistent partners that I don't orgasm with, and so that's pretty central for me too. Kind of like, why are you asking? Like, do I experience orgasm with sex? Like, yes? No? Am I misunderstanding the question? If I go to a restaurant and I get food, I'm not surprised when the food comes. That's why I was at the restaurant. I don't cheer when it happens. Like, I enjoy it. What do you expect at a restaurant? And so I say this not to give you the idea that sexual minority women have perfect sex lives or that heterosexual women are having unsatisfying with sex with men all the time, but to illuminate the very clear differences between what's expected and what, therefore what could be rationally desired out of sex. Now, we also look at testosterone and sex differences in desire. And again, I would say that it's pretty clear across most psych faculty, whether they're neuroscientists or, again, gender scholars, to think of testosterone as being one of the forces that drives sex differences in desire. So even if you look at like feminist gender psychology textbooks, that would be something people would be willing to grant. What we did is we actually looked at that. So what we show here is men expressing, reporting significantly higher sexual desire than women, which is almost every study has shown that. But I will tell you that some interesting work shows that within couples, men are actually not significantly more likely to report higher desire than their female couples. So when you, partners, when you do dyadic analyses, this actually doesn't hold up. But when you ask sort of random bunches of men and random bunches of women, you do get this response. We tried covariant testosterone, and if testosterone accounted for that difference, we would expect these bars to become the same, and they clearly don't. When we covariant masturbation rates, however, they do become the same, which tells us that masturbation seems more likely to account for the so-called sex differences in desire that might actually reflect gender sex. Now, you could think, well, masturbation seems just as likely to be reflecting an inner drive or biological than anything else, but masturbation is situated too. And you might think, well, isn't solitary desire and masturbation kind of the same thing? But clearly people have desires they don't act on, whether that's for a partner desire, solitary desire, anger at someone, hunger, right? In psychology, one of the mainstays of our research is that wants and cognitions are not the same as behaviors and actions, and we can't synonymize them. And that's probably a good thing because probably the case that in every, you know, not everyone's sitting here wanting to be sitting here. There's other things you want to be doing, but you're sitting here, so thank you. So masturbation is situated too, and that matters for understanding who has equal access to masturbation, just like who has equal access to partner orgasm. So we asked women, is it okay to masturbate while you're in a relationship? And here's what they told us. Our lesbian, bisexual, queer women, there was a really interesting bunch of like bursts of responses. Oh yeah, it better be. This is a compendium of some of them. I think it's fine. Hell yeah. And anyone that thinks it's not is no longer my boyfriend. For heterosexual women, this is one quote, again, not cherry picked, but emblematic of responses or a theme. For me, it's orgasm by myself is easier, but I don't know. I'm married. And so being married for me changed things. Like I almost feel like I'm cheating on my husband if I were to masturbate. I know that sounds kind of weird, but so I don't engage in that without. So again, who feels comfortable masturbating is a gendered construct. And that matters because masturbation has feed forward and feedback effects on desire and helps us understand some of the desire differences between women and men. It's not all just an inner construct or an inner drive. testosterone doesn't drive desire itself. It doesn't drive sex differences in desire. We've done some work where we actually pit testosterone versus a whole host of other things. Masturbation was the only other one that mattered. And what we find in one model is that masturbation significantly predicts desire and testosterone doesn't. And in another model, they both significantly do, but also there's a significant interaction between them. So what I'm trying to say is not that testosterone doesn't matter for any of these. It's clearly involved in many of these phenomena, but it's not the whole explanation. It's not directly linked, and it's very rarely clearly linked, and it's often not linked at all. Now, I really like this slide because I think it really nicely demonstrates the complexity of solitary and dyadic sexuality. What this is showing is, as we said, sexuality and sexual desire are not unitary. This is about sexual pleasure. That there's all sorts of things that are attached only to solitary pleasure in general, and this comes out of our thematic analyses with participants. Various things that come out of dyadic pleasure, so when people experience dyadic sexual pleasure, things like trust come up when they don't for solitary pleasure, and some shared factors. So it's not that dyadic and solitary pleasure are completely different, there's overlaps, but they're also not the same thing. There's overlaps and divergences that matter for how we think of sexual desire. We can do all sorts of methods to do this sort of research, so it's very rare in research on testosterone to hear reports of qualitative investigations, but if we want to understand what desire is and how it's experienced, which we need to understand how testosterone might be linked to it, we need to do work like qualitative work to get at it, and all sorts of various kinds of quantitative research as well to make sense of the ways these things might be related. Because how would we put all this together? By making sense of the social construct of desire, how it's socially situated, how people are experiencing it, we can have a better idea of figuring out how it's related to testosterone for those of us who are interested in that, which I am, right? We could think of desire as going into eroticism, but also many of those other low T phenomena as well, things that we think of as being associated with low testosterone. So if you remember earlier, I showed you the dyadic desire was negatively correlated with testosterone, which is kind of curious and not the normal thing we hear, although it's been replicated, we've replicated it, others have replicated it. That falls into that awkward surplus that we know exists, but we'd just rather put over there. And one of the reasons seems to be is that for mostly heterosexual women, not for most heterosexual women, but for our samples, which are often mostly heterosexual unless we're sampling, you know, because that reflects the population, orgasm is often not on the menu for their heterosexual encounters. And there's lots of evidence showing that. That doesn't mean it's never on the menu, doesn't mean it shouldn't be on the menu, but it often isn't on the menu. So what are heterosexual women wanting out of sex with their male partners if orgasm isn't even one of the options? And one of the possibilities is what they're wanting is intimacy, closeness, and so on. And that's not because women naturally want intimacy and closeness more than men or that they don't want orgasms, but that women are rational, like other people, and want what they can get. So when a woman says she has high sexual desire to be sexual with another person, orgasm isn't one of the things that is likely to be a part of that, then the other things are more likely to be what that desire is for. And that might help us understand, by understanding the social construction of desire and how it's experienced by heterosexual women, some heterosexual women. I feel like I have to constantly say, like, hashtag not all women, not all men. I'm sure everyone you know and we know has only incredible perfect sex. This helps us understand the ways testosterone might be linked. So that's important for those of us interested in human biology, but it's also important for those of us interested in sexual desire as well, which I am, even outside of a biological framework. So I want to leave you with a few conclusions, and let me check the time. I'm okay for... Perfect. Okay, good. We talked about testosterone as being the bioessence of maleness and sex, but I hope what I've been able to show you is that's actually pre-theory. That's a pre-theory model. Both the binaries are and the story of where T fits in that. We talked about how we can think about two really different, innovative, and complementary ways of socially constructing testosterone. One is the ways that cultural narratives drive what we might call a scientific imaginary, what scientists even think is worth or possible to study. And more than that, what we actually know about testosterone, because we've shaped and focused or canalized what we study, that means we only know these things about testosterone. The other is through gender socialization actually affecting the biochemical hormone that is testosterone that is circulating through our bodies, because we're sort of shunted into engaging in behaviors that either increase or decrease testosterone as a result of gender norms. Clearly not exclusively, but to some extent. I think that gender sex in social neuroendocrinology helps us think about how to break binaries. By using gender sex and not sex, we remind ourselves that when we study humans, even when we're studying things like testosterone or any human biology, we're always studying phenomena that exist in people that are not only evolved beings, but also socialized beings. It helps us think about testosterone is so tied to men, masculinity, and maleness, and I think of social neuroendocrinology as a way for us to get beyond that. A lot of the research I presented to you was in women, but most of the research on testosterone is only in men. And that really, that is part of that cultural shaping that makes us think that testosterone is a male hormone when there's almost no research on it in females except as something aberrant, let's say. And I don't mean it helps us get beyond men, maleness, and masculinity as in leave them behind. I mean it helps us get beyond simplistic notions of men, maleness, and masculinity and their ties to testosterone and helps us do more rigorous research on masculinity and the ways it might be engaged, the ways it might be associated with testosterone. And I think what's interesting, too, is that it helps us get away, even thinking about social neuroendocrinology, get away from thinking testosterone is only linked to gender sex or phenomena related to that. One of the projects I'm really interested in doing in the next year is thinking about the way testosterone as a social narrative doesn't just underlie maleness, masculinity, and men, but normative men, right? So that means white men, middle-class men, because we think of some men as hyper-masculine, and we see that playing out in the streets all the time, right, and on YouTube videos. And we see some men as hypomasculine in our cultures. And again, I think testosterone is a cultural narrative that is at work there, along with hyperaggressiveness, hypoaggressiveness, and various functions. So race, ethnicity, ability, nations, savagery, all those sorts of cultural ideas, I see testosterone at work as a cultural story there. I think of social neuroendocrinology as feminist science. We could call it socially situated neuroendocrinology. We could think of social modulation of hormones, which is the neuroscience-y way I might describe my work. Also is being described as the biomaterialization of lived experiences. And lived experiences are the ways that each of us in our unique constellation of social locations experience life in a sort of power hierarchy and structures and so on. And that is feeding back onto our bodies all the time. So we can think of social neuroendocrinology as a way to look at the ways our lived experiences are actually biomaterialized, meaning turned into biomaterial things in our body. And we can think of this as ways to do work on bio bodies in social context and also social bodies in bio context. Now briefly, I want to, because it's a philosophy and history of science, I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but I do teach feminist science studies in women's studies, and I think of social neuroendocrinology is informed by, I didn't talk about that much about what it's informed by, but informed by so much feminist science studies work. So Donna Haraway's Nature Cultures, the idea that the two are disentangleable. I actually think sometimes we want to talk about gender and sex as separate, and I think that's important. When I want to talk about pay equity, sexual coercion, I don't want to be talking about sex, I want to be talking about gender. But sometimes we do want to be talking about things like gestation and uteruses, which are not just social constructions, but biomaterial as well, and it's worthwhile keeping that in mind. I think of this as a way to really look at Butler's performativity. What does it mean to routinize our gendered behaviors for our biological bodies? Anne Festo-Sterling's Bare Bones of Sex, which is such a, and I'm not just saying that because she's here, but which is such a formational way for me to think about, and if you haven't read that article, I highly recommend it. It's a way to think about how our interactions in the world, our socialized interactions in the world shape our bodies. Karen Barad's entanglements, right? So the way that gender and sex are entangled and caught up in each other, interacting. Kim Talbert talks a lot about DNA stories, and I've tried to talk about testosterone as a cultural story, but not just a cultural story, but also importantly as a cultural story. And Patricia Hill Collins' treatment of intersectionality. I didn't talk very much about intersectionality except about queer and straight women, but there's all sorts of ways to think about how social location beyond gender and beyond sexual identity really matter for the biomaterialization of our experiences. So it's a way to do work, biological work that is not biologically reductive, but instead is biologically expansive. It's biology without the biological determinisms. And what I mean by biologically expansive is, if you think of desire, we started off with it as this really restricted thing, and we ended up with a lot of desire constructs, which is, the, you know, to me, is the literal opposite of biological reductionism. And finally, Anne Festo-Sterling asks, can we find a way to talk about the body without ceding it to those who would fix it as a naturally determined object existing outside of politics, culture, and social change? And that's been a guiding question for me in developing social neuroendocrinology. And I hope I've been able to convince you that social neuroendocrinology is at least one way, one nascent way, to try to think about how to answer this question. So I want to thank you so much for your time and attention and for having me here, and we're having questions now. Welcome. Any questions?